Hello, Radioland. You're listening to another episode of Darshiv. My name is Graham. This is 91.7 WHUS Doors. This is the weekly radio program where we talk about archives, we talk about resources that we have here at the University of Connecticut Library, folks who are involved in information work, archivists, etc., and then also people who just come and check out the archives. And today I've got a guest, probably the most international guest that I've had on the show so far. I'm joined with Wahib, who is a Susi student visiting from Algeria. Wahib, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Wahib, can you tell us a little bit about the Susi program, sort of what your interest was in visiting stores, and a little bit about what your personal interests are?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Susi program is an exchange program, 5 weeks program sponsored by the State Department. And we had to apply. Basically, it targets students from North Africa. So I applied from Algeria based on the Algerian Black Pearl, which is a radio station. It's a project that I'm trying to work on in Algeria. And I'm happy that I got selected, and here I'm a neocon.
That's fantastic. So you guys have been traveling around, kind of seeing some sites. What have you seen so far?
Yeah, we did. We actually went to Harvard. We went to Yale University. We also visited Boston. And in the last week, we're also going to visit D.C. and New York City as well.
Cool. Is this your first time in the States?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, awesome. What are your impressions compared to like what you sort of had in mind before you got here?
Well, I think that one of the things that surprised me is how friendly people are over here. I mean, it's like I you know, go to the dining hall in the morning and people are joking around. They all look at you and wave. That's not something that we have in Algeria. Like, if you don't know me, you don't wave to me.
Funny. Well, that's cool. I'm glad to hear that. So your interest in radio, I kind of want to know a little bit about that. And I'm glad that you were interested in coming on the air. We'd initially talked about this when you came with your group, which is predominantly a group of folks from North Africa. I think we had students from Morocco, students from Tunisia, Algeria, Sudan, Egypt, I believe, is all of them.
Yeah.
Which was really great. And so I've been working with this program for about 3 years now, bringing out materials from the archives, kind of specifically focusing on human rights records that we've got in our extensive collection about materials from all countries around the world. But your specific interest is in radio. Can you tell me a little bit about why the radio?
I think that what drove me the most to start a radio station is my obsession with communication field and media in general, and part of it is, I mean, since you do the records of human rights, part of it is when I watched a TED talk of Steven Pinker, his psychologist of Harvard University, was talking about the decline of violence in the world, and he said that one of the factors that led to that decline of violence is communication. People started communicating with one another, started learning languages, started visiting one another, and that led to some sort of understanding, empathy. Like he said, like any technology that can make you feel what it's like to be the other, that leads to a more let's say decline of violence, like more understanding.
That's fascinating. I know of a pretty prolific audio archivist named Tony Schwartz, who was working mostly from the late 20s up to 2008, I think, is when he passed away. But he kind of imagined that sound is actually one of the first things that we start to develop emotions around. Mm-hmm. The sound of someone getting angry or someone saying something lovingly actually has more of an effect on us than recognizing visual, you know, like whether a smile means something versus a frown. And then kind of juxtaposing that, the written word, right, took a very long time to travel, right? The newspaper, the news wire that was traveling across the globe when that first really became a thing, 19th century mostly. You could reach a community, you could impact people around you by the written word. However, it just didn't travel very fast. Whereas sound from like one coast to the other can travel in about 64th of a second, right? So the ability to just spread sound is really important. So I think in that regards, what you're speaking about, you know, I'm trying to think through radio in Algeria. Yeah. What is the basic infrastructure for folks listening to the radio? Is there public radio? Is there private radio? How do you go about broadcasting?
I think that it's like most of the radios in Algeria are national ones, means they're regulated by the government. And what it's like, there are a lot of subjects that are kept taboo in society, or let's say subjects that are only the youth that are obsessed with. And it's like having a radio where I can, let's say, highlight those taboo subjects, or like highlight those issues that are not discussed on the air, is something that I feel as kind of a mission.
Right. Yeah. Your ability to kind of speak sort of unbound by the communication controls. Yeah. We were talking a little earlier as I was showing you around the studio about the FCC and sort of the federal communications mandates that we have when we get on the air. Yeah. You have to sort of, you know, speak in a certain way up to a certain hour. Then after that, you can sort of be a little more free with your speech in a way. You have to give certain kinds of information over the air. So where do you broadcast? Is it mostly on the internet? Is this the major sort of broadcast area?
Yeah, that's what I do. I mean, I broadcast. We use the minimal tools. I mean, most of us are university students, so we use laptops, microphones. So there is a Radionomy website where you can actually like start your own radio channel, and then we make sure to fill out with the with songs that are kind of, you know, they work automatically. They are like when no one is broadcasting, there is a song being played 24/7, and there is that software. We can just like press the play button and you're live. So the first time like I started this radio station, I was kind of, I did that not with the intention to make it like a really popular radio or anything. I just did, you know, for fun. And then I said, wait a minute, maybe I can actually interview someone. And what I did was I actually sent a message to an American rapper. I said that I'm a fan of yours, like since high school and all. Like, what do you think about like having an interview? And surprisingly, he said yes.
Cool.
He said, yeah, I would be happy to do that. So we scheduled, and I opened like Facebook page for the radio, and then I put an event, like I'm going to have an interview with this rapper and all. And people started to be engaged with that. And when I had that first interview of mine, like I was, you know, was shaken.
Right. Yeah.
But that, it's like finding your, let's say, your passion. Like I found my passion in that.
Right. That's very cool. So in terms of kind of a community of listeners, who are you trying to reach with your radio? What is your general audience?
We like to reach youth from between 20 years old to, let's say, 35 to 40 years old. Most of them are students, and most of them are English speakers as well. Which is interesting, because in Algeria, our first language is Arabic, and our radio is English-speaking radio. And it was interesting because you pointed to the idea of the sound, like how, you know, when human beings created the sound language and how that led to more understanding and some sort of communication. And I also like to point out also to language. I mean, language is, I don't know if you heard about Terence McKenna. Mm. Like he used to go so wild when talking about language, like language is what led to evolution. Mm. That is also, I think, Chalmers or someone who said like having a second language is like having a second soul. It's like we think through language, you know, and having the ability to speak on the radio with a second language, English, I think that makes people listen to ideas or listen to conversations that they do not usually have in the Algerian society, that just like takes them out of the box, out of the bubble of the, you know, culture, like always the same things, the same routine.
And so would you say that there's an audience throughout North Africa, or through, you know, is it Pan-African in a way? Who sort of, where are the folks tuning into your station?
Anyone can tune into my station because it's an internet, but we try to focus on the Algerian community. But if we discuss a topic that is international, let's say, for example, because we organize a debate about socialism versus capitalism were the one who was pro-socialism is an Algerian, mm-hmm. and the one who was pro-capitalism was actually American.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not surprised,
so
actually.
So we had some American folks who were listening as well.
Right. Cool. So kind of to get back to the issues around access to radio, mm-hmm. I kind of just want to hear a little bit more about Algeria. What are kind of the challenges for folks to get into broadcasting or to listen to maybe some unrestricted broadcasting? Do you feel that there is a bit of a control there that that kind of needs to be discussed?
I think some of the difficulties that we face the most in Algeria is sometimes like slow internet, because we got some some broadcasters work with me in the radio, or sometimes they try to start broadcasting with the software and just and it starts cutting because of the slow internet, and it's not something that I can do anything about it, because the internet comes from like national agency, and you go there and complain, they wouldn't. It's like, that's what we have.
Right.
Yeah.
Not much you can do about that, because
exactly.
It is an infrastructure
exactly.
issue. Are there any kind of restrictions, I guess, in terms of the content that you can put on the air? I know that it's the internet. Most places in the world, the internet is maybe less controlled than in other parts of the world. But is there anything, like if you were to go into a radio station mm-hmm. tomorrow in Algiers and say, I would like to be on the air, would they sort of police how you went about conducting yourself?
Well, I don't know. I never worked in the national radio in Algeria, but I don't know. I think that they do have restrictions, but not so much on the internet. On the internet, you can be podcaster, say, talk about whatever you want, and you post the video on YouTube. No one is gonna say anything because the internet is for, which is great thing. We live in an age of the internet where you can say whatever you want. As for if the broadcasters in national radios in Algeria say wherever they want. I don't know much about that because I didn't work there.
Sure. So in a sense, it sounds more like it's not that there isn't access to the radio. It's that you have far more control and mobility around doing your own production. And I feel like this is a huge part of rap music actually too, is your ability to kind of set yourself up in your closet with your mobile device and just kind of begin riffing. So you now have tools, right? Communication mm-hmm. tools that we can sort of proliferate and kind of become our own individual radio DJs.
That's right. Yeah, I mean the ability to be independent is a great thing. If you really know what you're into and if you really have a message out there, I'm wearing now a shirt of Immortal Technique, who's an American rapper.
Mm-hmm.
And he's someone that I respect a lot, because he chose not to to sign with any recording label because he wanted to, some sort of preserve his authority over his lyrics. So, all the people who influenced me, they were people who were preaching about freedom. You have, try to take responsibility over the things that you say, yourself, not depending on someone else telling you what you're supposed to do, whether someone else or some entity, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. I do. So you'd kind of mentioned earlier about what a topic of your show was, capitalism versus socialism.
Yeah.
What's kind of the themes of a lot of your programs?
The thing is that we do shows based on each broadcaster's interests. So we got some broadcasters who are interested in politics, others are interested in social issues, others are just interested in music. So we try to create shows that go hand in hand with what they are interested in. So for example, in the capitalism versus socialism, it was actually a debate for 2 hours.
Long.
Yeah. And it wasn't during any show. It was a single debate during the week. We programmed that. We schedule a time for that. And I was the one who was monitoring the debate. And yeah, we had some time for each speaker, and we had time for questions. And we also, it's interesting because we also have a website of the radio where people, there is a chat box where people can listen, and at the same time they write things, they can also ask questions. So if there is something that someone asks and want us to ask the one who's speaking, we just just do that. Like, we deliver the message. That's what his fan, what this fan is asking. So can you answer that? Which creates like better communication, the radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's cool. It's, you know, a live chat alongside the actual conversation that's going on. Are there ever any conflicts in your sort of comment chat thread between, you know, someone's typing in Arabic something, a counterpoint, and then the English comes in and nobody, like, is there a communication breakdown sometimes because of this internationalism?
We haven't faced any of this, to be honest. Like, no one wrote in Arabic, no one sweared.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's because of our fan base. They're pretty much, most people who speak English in Algeria find them like the educated people. So yeah, they don't do that.
Right. Basically, the only thing that I know about Algeria is from the revolutionary period, the mm-hmm. anti-colonial struggle. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, your history in Algeria? Maybe a little bit about what common problems are in Algeria or common celebrations to happen in Algeria. I know it is one of many countries in North Africa. Some, like Libya, are in sort of very rough conditions right now, post-war, post-overthrow, etc. How does Algeria sort of situate itself in North Africa for you?
Well, it's in the records that we started. We were colonized by France. We started the revolution in 1954, and then we got our independence in 1962. After that, I think that, like, speaking about the current Algeria, I think that there are like some people who would say, like, the reason why we haven't done much, you know, in our country, we haven't built, you know, a lot of, let's say, some economy or something. They would say it's because we are post-war, you know, post-colonial, like, we were colonized by France. But the thing is that I don't think that I buy that. I think that, I don't know, it's just like a part of the past. I think now we should, like, look at the present and just go forward. Like, instead of just, you know, I don't like the victim mindset, that the reason we are what we are is because we were colonized by France. Like, no, I mean, yeah, that was 1962, we got our independence, and now let's move forward.
Hmm. Sure. I think a lot about the really well-known sort of critical scholar Frantz Fanon, who kind of talks a lot about post-colonization. He is from Martinique. He went over as a physician to Algiers to kind of assist with kind of the revolutionary struggle, mm-hmm. taking his part as a physician, which I think is pretty radical, actually. I think a lot about my knowledge of Algeria comes more from people like him, who think of in a very sort of interesting and critical way about the neo-colonial position, sort of subjectivity in the world as a colonized body, but also a man who was trained thoroughly in French and the philosophy of French people at a very Western tradition. So what's the relationship, I guess, between Algeria and France today? Like, you're saying that the second spoken language is English, which I'm interested in.
No, the second language is French.
It is French. Okay, yeah. Good. So I was going to say, if it's not French, then what happened to the French?
Yeah. Most of people in Algeria, they speak French, especially in the capital. Because when France left, there were like a lot of, let's say, a mixture of immigration. There were like still French people living there, still like a lot of Europeans. So Algiers, which is the capital, grew to be this like multicultural Algerian French state. And a part of that, as I said, I don't like, you know, the victim like mindset. Mm. I mean, there is actually, and to be honest, there are a lot of Algerians, and not only Algerians, I mean North Africans in general, where instead of learning from the past, they complain about the past. You know, I mean, I try to learn from the mistakes that we did, try to learn from the histories of the others, like what happened. Let's study about France, let's study about the United States, let's see the mistakes that they did, and let's try to learn from them. You learn from every part of the world. There's actually, it's an interesting quote from a famous Algerian philosopher, Malik Ibn Nabi. He said that the problem with us, he said the problem with us Algerians is that, he was talking about actually the experience of Japan, how it was this you know, underdeveloped country, and then in, you know, a few years it went to the top in their economy. He said that the difference between the Algerian and the Japanese mind is that the Japanese person, the Japanese individual, he looks at the world with the lens of a student. Like, he wants to learn from what happens in the history of the others, and let's bring what's benefits. But he said, like, but the Algerian individual, he looks at the world with the lens of a teacher. Like, we got all the answers, you know.
Right, sort of a condescending way of looking
exactly.
at the world.
Yeah.
Because what can you learn if you're just a teacher? Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. That's an interesting way of thinking about it. In terms of other countries within North Africa, what are the relations with Algeria and, say, Tunisia, which I think also has a long sort of relationship with France? It's got its own kind of post-colonial operation. I mean, most North Africa has mm-hmm. the same kind of history. What kind of relations does Algeria have with other North African countries?
I think that the relationship that we have with Tunisia is basically based on tourism. Because you got a lot of Algerians, they go to Tunisia to go to the beaches and all. Like, Tunisia is well known by being like a really, really good tourist country. Like, people from Europe, they come there as well. So the first destination in terms of tourism in Algeria is Tunisia, actually. Mm. Aside from that, there is Morocco, but not many Algerians, they go to Morocco, which is actually the opposite. I think that more Americans, they know about Morocco more than, yeah, Algeria and Tunisia.
Right. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, in terms of the students that you traveled here with, I know you guys didn't all get on the same plane, but you are here together in stores. Has it been kind of a learning process also, kind of dealing with other folks, working with them on a daily basis to kind of understand where they come from, also in the same region where you are, but have you learned much from them in terms of just where they come from?
That's not my first program here. Mm-hmm. For the others, it's not my first program. It is my first program here.
Got it.
Because, yeah.
Got it.
Because I had another exchange program where I was in Sweden for 3 weeks, and we had people from all over the Middle East and North Africa as well. And what's interesting, I always, you know, the first time I came to the program, I was thinking that, you know, I'm gonna find like a lot of cultural differences, a lot of barriers, a lot of some sort of things that are not common in terms of food or language or, you know, the way you think about the world and all. But it was actually the opposite. I mean, I found out that our culture is really homogenous. I mean, it's like you people are much, much similar than how we're usually led to believe, mm-hmm. you know, especially in Middle East and North Africa.
Right. Like these places that are sort of historically, and at least in the 20th century for sure, sites of conflict and sites of post-war dividing and conquering. So, of course, your association is like, oh, well, they must be against each other in some base way.
Yeah. Look, you got religion, you got language, you got history, you got race, like Arabs. So Arab, Islam, the history, the colonization, and also something that is interesting is globalization. Now people, like especially us as youth, I mean, we grow up watching, you know, some sort of same movies, mainstream ones, same mainstream music. So our, you know, our personalities are shaped in a way that are similar to one another.
Right, which can be a strong bond for sure. My interest in kind of what you're saying about globalization is, where does your identity start to take you away from the place that you're from because of globalization?
A lot of people would point to that as negative and as a positive. Some people say it's negative, some people say it's positive. I don't know, man. I mean, it's like there are some positive things about the people who say it's a negative thing is people who are too stressed and too afraid that they will lose their culture. You know, the things that you would get ecstatic when you visit some place with some historical sites. You know, and then you feel those were different people to me. They were living with different language, different way of seeing the world. They kind of innovated different things to us. But now it's like you go to the other side of the world and you kind of, you know, have the same movies or people who talk just like Americans, for example.
I've been here before, right?
Yeah.
That's a funny kind of way of thinking about it, too. And I feel like this experience happens a lot with, again, maybe some form of the travel of audiovisual. You think of, you know, the pyramids in Egypt, or for me, it was when I visited Peru and went to Machu Picchu. You know, you've seen these photos of these amazing places. You have to go see them. But then when you get there, you're like, wait, I have seen these over and over again.
You'll get disappointed.
And it's like, geez, I'm not present, clearly, because I'm not appreciating this thing that's directly in front of me.
Because you're looking for the adventure. You're looking to be ecstatic. You're looking to be surprised. You want, like, literally to be shocked by new information. Like, you want to feel that you're in a different place. But then you go there, you talk to people, and then it's like you kind of relate. I mean, this guy talks or thinks the same way that my neighbor, the neighbor that I have, you know, or my friend. Or
right.
Not only the personalities, but also the you know, the architecture, you know, of the place.
Sure. Yeah, there's an element of the humanness that is just kind of an inherent quality that all of us more or less have. And then thinking about, yeah, places of living and streets, you know, kind of trying to navigate a 21st century world.
That's right.
There are not that many places that are distant at this point.
Yeah.
Well, that's very fascinating to me. And so I've always thought about the program, and there's another group that comes regularly from Southeast Asia. Maybe that group is a little less homogenous, I would say, in terms of religion and in terms of not necessarily cultural differences, but there's a lot more dividing that has almost happened in a way more recently in that part of the world. So, yeah, I've always kind of wondered what they thought. Was it more of a cultural mashup? This year you have someone from Sudan, I know, in the group, which that country was not part of this group before.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know the details of how these things get decided, but have you ever traveled with any group from a country that you were like, wow, someone made it from this country? I've only heard bad stuff, like a Darfur, you know, happening in this place.
Well, in the last program when I was Sweden, we had like two people from Palestine.
Wow.
And the only thing I heard from Palestine is like war and people are... I was like, you guys have an airport?
Right. It's still there?
Yeah. You know, I think that one of the reasons I would relate radio to the common good of the people is something that I noticed. I can give you an example from the United States, and we can take it to Algeria, because I follow global politics as well. For example, here since we had debate about socialism and capitalism, there are those people who are trying to, let's say, seek out the truth in the world. And let's say they are confused between socialism or capitalism. And then, out of the sudden, they're exposed to the fact that, for example, living in South Korea is better than living in North Korea. And they know also that North Korea is socialist country and South Korea is capitalist country. So they run with this. This is a fact. But they run out and take the extreme radical points of views, like any kind of, you know, governmental assistance is bad, any kind of, you know, thinking about small elements of socialism is bad, because now it's gonna move gradually to North Korea, you know. But it's similar what's happening in Algeria when only one fact is presented. Like, I see that happening all the time. I think that one of the things that maybe most of the listeners of this radio, especially Americans, they know, but like people who follow international news, they know that in the Middle East and North Africa, I mean, those regions are the kind of really slow in terms of their progress when it comes to their attitudes towards women and, you know, the LGBT community. And I was thinking about the reasons why we're slow, you know, it's in our progress. And I think that part of it is the media. I think that, for example, when it comes to, let's talk, for example, about women's rights. In Algeria, let's say we got someone, a female, who is in a position of power. And that female turned to do a lot of stupid things or something. The media points to that, you know, that's the first female and this is what she did. So people are going to take this fact and they take the radical stance that every female is going to you put her in charge. This is exactly what the outcomes is going to be. And, you know, like, what about the other females that did like good things? What about the other women that are heroes, actually? What about not highlighting those people as well? You know, it's like highlighting only one side. And when you got space where only one side is highlighted, people think that that's the only side and that's the only truth. You do not provide space where that opinion is actually put into context. It is actually battled, challenged, and you present counter argument to it. And this is what I think about my radio. I mean, I like to run debates because I think that I think it's good to have a space where there are like a battle of ideas and the best ideas would win. Like, this is the subject, I got two sides, talk about it. Let's see. Yeah, let's see who makes more sense.
Right, which is an interesting idea because I feel like in the United States, usually it's the funder who more or less decides what the content will be. Mm-hmm. And then they kind of, you know, carry this out. You immediately think of the kinds of politics that, say, Fox News is advocating, or what kinds of politics Huffington Post is advocating, like very polarity based, but still like just party politics. It's almost like this is all that Americans can think about. They're not they're not even able to untap from a two-party system, which, you know, it has its own, won't go into it. But so in a sense, I feel like what you're saying too is that, you know, there is kind of a bait in the media, or at least the way that the media is portrayed. There's something that is very easily consumed. So in a sense, how can you go about trusting the listeners of that media? So, you know, why can't people decide critically that what they're hearing is not the truth?
Sometimes I ask myself the question, like, why does the media do this? Do they not think that it's immoral, it's stupid what they're saying? But at the same time, I feel like they're just trying to make money. They look at the audience. Let's say we do a couple of shows, and let's see which show that brings most of the audience. So that's what they do. I mean, they just want to make money. They don't have this mission, like they just want to, like, say, seek truth or something like that. They just want to, you know, there is like the culture, there is the mainstream opinions, and let it be. I mean, we just want to make money, just want to have more listeners, which is something that I'm really, really against. I think that the problem with those people is that, like, as you said, like you asked me, like, why do they not think critically? I mean, I think critically all the time. As for why they don't think critically, I think that it's just sometimes it's hard to think. Sometimes they're afraid. A part of that, like, but like to me, what I consider myself, I mean, people say that you're, you know, radio journalist, a broadcaster. But what I like, I mean, I don't do that as just a humanitarian mission, but it's actually a passion to me. I mean, you're doing radio and you're studying university, and that's great. I mean, I like that. But at the same time, I think I see myself as someone who's interested in intellectual orgasm, you know, something like that. It's like I like to have conversation with people we about controversial issues where I just want to seek the truth. Like, what is it? What is it in there?
Sure. And that's kind of the basis of academia, right? There's this space that we have decided is a place for you to have dialogue, to learn, to sort of have an interaction with each other and ultimately come out with, you know, a little bit better understanding of maybe what the other position is, or sort of how to, you know, work our chops about changing things that we already see the problems in. And I feel like that's a big role of the university. So I'm happy to hear that, you know, you're a student. We should all be students, of course. So, in terms of thinking about, you know, the consumption of media and sort of your role in providing what kind of sounds like difficult radio in a way, like if you're having hard debates on the radio, there's a very particular kind of person that wants to hear that. And maybe the other kind of entertainment news is populist, right? Like it's wanting to feed you the idea that is the most salient. It's sort of the most entertaining almost. Mm-hmm. And that's an easy thing to pass your day with.
I mean, we have broadcasters who do those entertaining shows. I mean, we got some, for example, a show, Priada Club, where they point to music, trend in music, the singers, and they try to have conversation with people. We got people who can call on the radio, and they can talk about their favorite singers, and they talk about the latest, you know, trends and all. But we also taboo shows. We also got technology shows.
Yeah, that's also, you know, not everything, well, I won't say not everything is about politics. I'm sure a lot of critical thinkers would say otherwise, but
I say otherwise.
So in a way, yeah, there are also things that you need to provide on the airwaves that are just going to help you, you know, sort of understand somebody else, not necessarily in a debate forum. I get that for sure. What's been your most interesting show that you've had? If you can think of one.
My most interesting show, I think it was Curiosity. But we, it's, you know, it's interesting because sometimes I ask myself this question, like, am I supposed like to talk about what I want or what the people want to listen to? You know, so we had this show, it's called Curiosity, but it didn't appeal much audience as the other shows, you know. But I really liked it because we talked about not political, not social subjects, but philosophical subjects like free will, like are we free or not? We discussed religion. We discussed, the purpose of life, nihilism, depression, like those things. Like, and we went like too deep into that, like trying to come up with statistics, come up with, you know, what psychologists are saying, what philosophers said about that. And but I think that when doing those, when talking about those subjects, like you have to understand not everyone wants to engage in that intellectual conversation. And not everyone is capable to do that, to be honest.
Right. Yeah. No, it's true. I also find when you have a radio program, you know, you're trying to think as broadly as possible in terms of application, who is interested in these kinds of things.
Yeah.
I have a radio show about the archives. That's a pretty obscure thing that I'm constantly trying to break down.
And how is it going?
I think it's going well. The podcast forum is a little bit more of what the kids listen to these days. You probably know that better than I do. But the college radio is maybe a more generational format, which is sad to me because I remember listening to college radio when I was in college, when I was younger than that, and just wanting, you know, to listen more so to an analog format. Whereas now, and I know you sort of advocated for this at the beginning of the show, that, you know, you have this portability. It's very easy to record on the radio. You can set up and do all your programming in a very fast and digital way. But like my first car had a radio in it and a tape deck, and I like that. There's something about that that I really like. So what do you think about just analog radio?
So you're also interested in doing radio. I mean, you do the records of human rights records, but at the same time, like, you're interested in doing the radio. And there is this famous quote where they say, if Aristotle were living today, he would be a show host. And I try to turn it to be, he would be a radio host.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Because in a way, like, yeah, political forum, political debate, I think usually you think about talk radio. That's exactly where that stuff happens. So in terms of the national radio, I just kind of want to ask, the public radio that you have in Algeria, we have one here, National Public Radio. Mm-hmm. I think it's very good, but also you know exactly kind of what you're going to hear when you tune in to National Public Radio.
Exactly.
They speak in a particular way.
Oh, my God.
It's almost like a, you know, it's like a Portlandia bit that you could watch at any time. There's just, you know exactly the level of conversation you're going to hear. How does that compare to the one in Algeria?
I think it's the same thing. Oh, my God. I mean, it's like they speak like robots. When you really think about it, like, why are podcasts getting more popular these days? And I think that the reason is because sometimes, like, I personally like to listen to people who are being themselves. Like, I really refuse that fake language, that fake tone and all. Like, it's like, imagine you're sitting in your room and someone shows up and speaking like this. You're going to be like, you know, who the hell is this weirdo? Right. Like, why are you talking to me like this? Like, I just want an honest conversation. Like, tell me what you really think. And let's talk about that. But it's kind of understandable about when thinking about the restrictions that they have. And this is why independence is good. And being independent allows you to be yourself, allows you to, to move forward, to progress, to change your mind, to talk about what you think and all those things. And I think that we're moving, I see this not only in the radio, but also the, let's say, TV channels as well. I mean, you see those people who talk like robots all the time. And it's weird. I think that it's getting, the first time this standard language showed up like in human history, I think it was in politics, in diplomacy, where you're supposed to talk in a certain way and not to upset people, or you're supposed to talk in a certain way to appeal, you know, audience so they can vote for you if, for example, you're running for elections. And it's getting worse, man. I mean, it's really getting worse. I mean, for example, when you read about what's happening in the global politics, you're going to find that there are people who are actually getting paid in order to tell the candidate what they are supposed to use in terms of keywords, like, you're supposed to say this in your speech and say that and this statement and say it in this tone and do and make this gesture, because they know that the people are going to be appealed to that. So that's like, we're not being honest at all. I mean, it's just like we're living in an artificial society where everyone says something for a purpose.
Right. Yeah. Like, which demographics can you check off by making particular appeals to various generational groups? Yeah, I can't disagree with that at all. So I'm totally on board with that. Any closing topic you wanna touch on before we head out?
I think I would like to give a shout out for all the fans that we have in Algerian Black Pearl Radio in Algeria. I would like to thank the instructors of this program that was sponsored by the Department of State. I mean, it's like really, really great experience. I would like to thank the people who supported me, my girl Canvas, my friends, my family, and just keep pushing forward. And I would like to thank you for having me.
And how can people listen to your radio, Wahib?
abpradio.ro.tn or Algerian Black Pearl on the Facebook page. You're gonna find us there. We tune in live, we have debates, we have events.
Well, it's been great sitting down and chatting with you about your experience with the SUSE program, your interest in radio, and sort of just what it's like in Algeria. And hopefully we can hear a little bit more of that on the airwaves in the near future. So be sure to check out Wahib's station. Hey there, welcome back. So after concluding the interview with Wahib, who was a visiting student from the SUSE program, we now have the academic director of the SUSE program here, Jack Berry, who is a postdoc fellow at the Global Training and Development Institute at UConn. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Graham.
So after having that rich discussion with Wahib, I'm kind of interested now to hear about sort of the grander sort of overlook of what the program is all about. Can you talk a little bit about the SUSE program itself, how long you've been involved in it, and kind of what the goals of the program are?
Sure, yeah, I'm happy to talk about this program because many Americans haven't heard about it or even know kind of what it is. But it's a long-running State Department program. Since the 70s, it's been around. And there's different themes of it. Social entrepreneurship is one, which is what we have here at UConn. But there's others in civic engagement and environment and even religious pluralism is one of the SUSEs. So the students come here for 5 weeks. Here at UConn, we, at a Global Training and Development Institute, we won the grant to bring them here. And they stay for 4 weeks at UConn. And then we take them down on a study tour to New York, to Philadelphia and to DC, which the students are quite excited to see. But they really end up enjoying their time at UConn. So what they do in the program is work on a business plan with me on a social enterprise they want to build. So this ranges from small economic development projects to ones that are more environment-based, or as Wahib's project is, based on media and the free radio in Algeria. So they really range, and it's exciting to work with them. And you see a lot of growth during the program.
Right. And so they have all kinds of different activities. I'm assuming they also visit other sort of units around campus other than just the archives, which is where I overlap with most of these folks.
Yep. So the program has three major academic components that we have to cover. One is American culture and history. So we actually take them down to the State House in Hartford. We take them to History Museum. We take them to the Pequot Museum. Take them to Boston for a day, where we go to the JFK Presidential Library. Take them to Harvard and kind of show them some American culture and history. At UConn, we also are involved with the leadership office. So that's the other component of the program is leadership. So we have leadership academic classes. We do the Four Arrows challenge, which is team building. And we are involved with a lot of the different departments at UConn. We have political science teachers, human rights teachers, business teachers. So many different teachers from the university are engaged with the program as well. And then, of course, we take them to the dairy bar.
Every trip to UConn has to have some tie-in with the dairy bar there.
Yep.
So I was wondering, I guess, in relationship to the material that I tend to bring out for these folks, which are drawn mostly from the human rights collections. We look at a lot of Amnesty International reports about the countries that these folks come from, which always makes me feel a little bad, because it's like, come on down to see the bad things that have happened in your countries. But, you know, I always have to contextualize with the fact that, you know, our archive is also full of things happening here in the United States that are sort of, you know, gross mm-hmm. human rights violations and whatnot. So in terms of why these particular countries were chosen and these particular individuals were chosen from those countries, is this kind of like pockets of the world that the State Department is kind of trying to work on through these development programs?
Yeah, that would be a little bit more of a high-level State Department decision for what makes different countries get these programs. Yeah. Many of them, like for this program, we have Egypt, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, and Sudan. We used to have Yemen and Libya in this program, but the countries went into civil war, and then they were taken out of the program because the government couldn't handle it. Sometimes it could be geopolitical decisions that I'm not aware of. But in general, if the students are people in that country are involved with these topics, the State Department sees benefit to having them come and learn from us, and we learn from them. So I don't know exactly how they should make those decisions, but we've noticed that most of the countries stay in the program. They don't kick out or move different countries often.
Right. Yeah. Just that waxing and waning of who arrives, and hopefully this program kind of, you know, shows further example of why these kinds of exchanges kind of need to continue to be funded. Yeah. In terms of the projects that these folks are developing when they come to work with you and they come to sort of visit places to kind of further their education about the projects they want to do, you were mentioning that there's a continuation where kind of you do work after they have left the United States.
Sure. Yeah. One of the exciting things we've developed with this program is a hybrid learning. So before they arrive, we actually send them online work to do on social enterprise. And then they come here, meet us in person, they meet our teachers, and then they go home. And rather than just saying, well, goodbye, see you later, we actually engage with them for another, I would say, 6 months to a year even. They'd finish the online component, and then they apply for a business grant or a social entrepreneurship award is what we call it. And it's only for about $500. We're thinking of upping the amount, but it's mainly to help them kind of get on their feet and get going and to be recognized by a university, recognized for their work. And so I work with them to make their plans strong enough to get that small bit of funding. But it's exciting. We've seen some emerge to be leaders in their fields from scratch. We've seen some develop a project that was already running but then got stronger. We've seen some totally change their idea upon getting here and talking it through with us. So it's pretty dynamic academically, as there's a lot of change, which is exciting. And these are young folks. The age range tops out at 25 for this program. So it's supposed to be about younger leaders in their countries.
I'm always fascinated, too, by just how energetic they are and how, I guess, willing to learn and then engage even with me when we're having our archive session. And I got to say, it's one of the most refreshing sessions that I do with students all year. They have so much like desire, and it's not tempered a bit by like social dynamics. They just kind of feel ready to absorb. And it's always so refreshing to kind of hear folks ask questions and like want to touch things, where usually, you know, it's like, please, like, come handle the material. Like, that's why the archives exist. So I got to say, I really enjoy being able to host that group at the archives as often as I've been able to.
Yeah, they're super dynamic, and they really have a want of learning and a want to engage. And they tell me in a lot of their, most of them are in college or just out of college. And they tell me in their classes, it's often top down teacher telling them what to do in a room of 200 people. There's not much engagement. So when they get here, they almost become free to say what they want to say and engage with the teachers, and they really take it to heart. And so wherever I take them, they really light up a room. They have questions. The main problem is stopping the questions, because they will go on for a long time. And so that's more the problem than trying to manufacture questions and debate. Like, they're ready and willing, especially this North African group. They're very politically engaged and curious about things, curious about why the United States is the way it is and why what we know about their countries, which they find out pretty quickly. Most people maybe have heard of Egypt and Morocco, but they have not often heard of Algeria or Tunisia. Or if they've heard about it, they don't know much about it. Typical, the average American, really.
Right. Well, that eagerness is a great problem to have. Well, in that sense, too, I'm wondering, when folks are kind of having to see that mirror reflection when they come over here of what the perception is of the countries that they're from. Do you ever find any kind of major sort of cultural exchange happening within the group themselves, even though they're from a region that seems somewhat homogenous? And at least that's how he was describing it, based on, religion, race, a lot of times language. There is some homogeneity between the countries themselves. Do you see any sort of major cultural differences that tend to come out?
Absolutely. And we often start the program off with each country giving a presentation about their history, their culture, to each other. And they often really like that part of the program, because they learn things about Algeria learning about Egypt, or Egypt learning about Morocco, that they didn't know. So they really bond as a group often. Sure, there's with 20 people in that we have here at UConn in this program, there's schisms and they don't all get along, but they really seem to, this group especially this year, 2018, is really bonded. And I think part of it is just curiosity about learning about the other countries. It's pretty exciting to see that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Just as far as some differences are concerned, the Egyptians have trouble, for instance, understanding some of the Moroccan Arabic, which is always interesting to us. And often sometimes French breaks out in class because the countries, not Egypt, but Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco speak French. This time with Sudan, there's also even more difference of culture going on, more exchange. So they bond as a group, and there's some regional identity going on. I think the State Department also wants to foster some of that as well. I think it's kind of trying to, bring global citizens together. And that naturally happens, really, when you get 20 people in a room from different places.
Right. That's interesting. And I know that in the past, when I have had the group through the archives, I've been able to bring out material that is in Arabic that, I'm trying to figure out as the archivist, where is this stuff from? can anyone here, do a translation for me and try and identify, this newspaper, the set of newspapers is from Iraq specifically, or from Afghanistan or something, anywhere from the region. So that's been really beneficial, because we have also been able to bring out materials that not a lot of people can appreciate in the same way, not just for the language reasons, but also for understanding kind of where the politics come from when you're dealing with issues about the Arab Spring in a very, local, specific kind of topical way. So yeah, that's always been helpful for me to be able to bring these things out for folks.
It is always exciting to see them in the archive, because I've noticed they often come to me after and say, some of that information in there I've never seen before. Our government doesn't talk about that. I've never researched that. It's hard for me to find this information. So the archive is always a highlight of their time here at UConn, and to see a world class archive is exciting for them. Some of them are really impressed with how overall America takes care of a lot of its history and preserves things. That's a common, especially after a common perception they leave with. And after we take them down to Independence Hall in Philadelphia, we take them to the 9/11 Memorial in New York. We take them to the Smithsonian's in Washington, and the archive here, they really notice that this is different than back home.
Right. And that was going to be my next question, kind of what is the role of these cultural heritage institutions on your sort of tour through the Northeast? Is it to kind of introduce to them the history of this place, or is it kind of about, you know, the dialogue of the historical past and its contemporary present?
Yeah, it's a good question. Our SUSE program's lucky being in Connecticut because we can take them to Boston. We take them to New York. New York is quite an international draw. The students always are excited to see that as a cultural icon of our current times. They think they have seen movies about New York, and then they're excited to be walking down those streets. As far as education is concerned, we like to show different parts of America. We like to show homelessness in Hartford. We like to show them people living in ways that they wouldn't expect from some of the movies they might watch, including in New York. And some of the cultural heritage sites tells the story of that. We take them to Ellis Island, for instance, which shows some of the immigrant story and how different groups have had trouble when they arrived in different times in our history. So we don't whitewash American history. We found, or we've heard, other programs maybe have tried that in the past, and it's not effective because the students figure it out. Try to show them the different types of history from the Pequot Museum to Independence Hall. It's hard to know the exact theme. It's more of the broad American history and culture. We also take them to social enterprises on this trip. So that also is part of the education, is continuing the social enterprise aspect rather than only American history and culture.
I have to applaud that sort of approach. Just in terms of the, you know, vulnerability and humbleness almost of like, here, can I introduce you to the country that you've heard so much about, but then here are the things that we are dealing with, which gives me some confidence knowing that, okay, they are getting that side from you guys instead of just one-way traffic from me about the Middle East and Amnesty International reports. Jack, is there anything else you wanted to touch on before we sign off?
No, just mainly I wish more Americans knew about this program. Those who meet these students really find them engaging. I mean, they're chosen from hundreds of, in some cases, some countries, thousands of applicants to come here. And they also have English skills that are top notch. So they really are great when you meet them. And they're also in the social entrepreneurship, at least. We're lucky here at UConn to have that topic because they really changed the world types. So they're coming here for the right reason, with open ideas, open minds, and I wish more Americans had the chance to meet them. And we facilitate that. It's open to the public. There are events here, many of their events at UConn. So if any of the local people who are in the area or working at UConn would like more information, it's on our website, and we have their presentations are available to the public. You can come in person and meet them. They do homestays with Connecticut families, which is often we get great feedback about that. But we need more people to do the homestays as well. So if you're interested in getting more engaged, these are really engaging students, and we're lucky to have them. So that's the one thing I guess leave with is it's a small program, but it's very powerful.
That's great. Well, I'm fortunate to be a part of this also, and in the exchange that they bring with them every year to be able to
we're fortunate to have you.
Awesome. Well, thanks very much, Jack. So again, we are joined with Jack Berry, postdoc fellow at the Global Training and Development Institute at UConn here, currently serving as academic director for the SUSE program. Thanks again for being on the show, Jack.
Thank you, Graham. Really appreciate it.
All right. We will catch everybody next week. You've been listening to another episode of Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. You can find out more about the UConn Archives and Special Collections at UConn Archives on Twitter and Facebook. Subscribe on iTunes or listen online at whus.org. Our theme song is Dream in Casio Tone by Arable Lands, graphic design by Melica Bloom. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.